Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani on IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'm so happy to be with all of you today. I have a great show planned. My guest today will be Patrick Holden, and Patrick is the founding director of the Sustainable Food Trust, whose mission is to promote international cooperation between all involved in sustainable food production. And I'm so thrilled to have him on. I met him last month at Terra Madre in Italy, and I'm really excited to bring him on in just a bit. First, though, I want to talk to you about some things going on in and around the city, some things going on in the news, and some things that I'm always coming across that just shocked me. This morning, I was actually reading yesterday's paper. You know, I get the New York Times every week, and, you know, I really look forward to Wednesday's food section. I open the food section, and on the front page is this huge, artificially colored, sprinkled funfetti cake. And I started reading the article, and I just couldn't believe it. I mean, here's somebody who, a woman who started at a bakery, you know, with high-end ingredients. She's going to be, you know, an artisanal bakery, and then she caught wind of the love that people have with sprinkles and the millennial kids who grew up with sprinkles. And, you know, she just started adding sprinkles to her cakes, and voila, you know, she's become a hit. And it just shocks me with all the work that I'm doing, Patrick's doing, everybody out there is doing to try to raise awareness about the garbage in our food system, to just think that people are so easily swayed by artificial coloring. It just blows me away. It's just crap. And why people want to eat something that looks so fake, I just cannot understand. You can make things taste so delicious using real ingredients that do you really need those colors? If you need those colors, get some paint and, you know, get to the canvas and create some art. But this just isn't it. You can't eat things that look like that and think you're going to stay healthy. It's just crazy. So anyway, I just had to share that because it always upsets me. You know, every week I put out a newsletter, and this week I put out my newsletter and reviewed, you know, some comments that Ronnie Commons, who is the, you know, the director of the Organic Consumer Association, he went to the Monsanto People's Assembly and Tribunal at The Hague this, you know, a few weeks ago. And he just, you know, did a review about that, just saying how we're getting to this point where we all have to come together on a global movement. You know, we can't keep having our separate GMO organizations or our organic organization, you know, someone for against fracking, someone else against the oceans, that we really have to bring all these shared issues together so that we can become one loud voice and resist the corporations like Monsanto that are pushing their agenda on us and taking over our food supply. We really have to come together, and I just thought it was so perfect to be writing about that and knowing that I'll be having Patrick Holden on in just a little bit to talk to us about the work he's doing in trying to bring people together. And I am just so excited to learn how we can really build a global movement so that we can stand up against these huge corporations that are just taking over. So I'm excited to talk about that in just a little bit. Coming up, I have an annual event that I do, which is I partner with the River Fund Food Pantry. They've been serving New Yorkers who don't normally have access to good, healthy food, and they've been really working hard to get fresh produce in there as well. But every year I partner with them and bring a huge Thanksgiving feast to homeless people or people that are willing to stand for 4 hours online to get a really good home-cooked meal. You know, people always say, are they really homeless? They have a cell phone, you know. And, you know, I tell people, don't judge, you know. Just because you have a cell phone, that might be your link to everybody. But you're still willing to stand online to get your food. You deserve to be there. And so it's a wonderful event. Over 100 people come through my home over the extended weekend while we cook a home-cooked meal for
we're almost up to 1,000 people now. I'd say there's like 600 or 700 people that come to the park, and then we cook enough food for them to bring some of the food around to a battered women's shelter and a men's homeless shelter. And so it's an event that's just wonderful. If you want to sign up and participate, I have a sign up on my website at ieatgreen.com. And there's 3-hour shifts set up that you can come. And so, you know, we're scrubbing 200, 300 pounds of potatoes in one bathtub and 200, 300 pounds of another, the sweet potatoes in the other bathtub. And it's just, you know, every single part of my home gets used. And it's a real community event. And I couldn't do it without the help of people in the community. And I get donations of food. And it's a really wonderful coming together. So if you want to sign up for that, like I said, you can find that on my website. Also, some other really great things going on. Of course, Halloween is coming up. And on Halloween this year, I talked about last week going down to Washington, D.C. and participating in a performance art piece in front of the White House called I Want a President. Well, that performance art piece is being brought up to the High Line on Halloween. And it's a performance art piece. The original document was created by an artist named Zoe Leonard. And they have put her original document up on a huge wall up on the High Line in New York City. And standing in front of that on Halloween, hundreds of people will come down to read not only Zoe Leonard's original document, but leading up to the event that happened in Washington, there was workshops creating a new, more modern document that is relevant to us here in America today, and actually having read it, it's really relevant around the world, of what we'd like to see with our president. And then there was also an opportunity for individuals to display what they would like to see in their president. Of course, you know, on my board, I said, you know, I'd like to see a president that saw access to food as a given right, and also a president that wanted to fix the broken food system. My sister, who is a midwife, you know, wants to have a president that has experienced a home birth. We all could bring our own personal issues to it, but that's going to be taking place up at the High Line on Halloween. That's Monday, October 31st at 6 o'clock. If anybody wants to come down and participate in that, it should be a wonderful happening. Leading up to Halloween, there are a lot of other things going on. Peekskill is having a Halloween ball, which is also a fundraising event to resist the Spectra pipeline that is being built up there in Westchester. That's going to take place in Peekskill. All of these things that I'm just going to run through really fast, you can find on my website, as well as many more. I'm not going to go over everything. Right now, it's Long Island Restaurant Week going on, and it ends November 6th, so you can take part in a 3-course price fixed meal at some of your favorite restaurants. There is an event taking place through Slow Food East End to raise awareness about the Long Island Cheese Pumpkin. The Long Island Cheese Pumpkin is a variety of pumpkin that was near extinction, and it's being brought back. The seeds are being saved through a seed consortium, and people are starting to plant the Long Island Cheese Pumpkin again. And this is a Cheese Pumpkin Barn Social. It's a potluck supper in a barn out on Long Island. Should be really fun. It's only $15 for Slow Food members and $20 for others. You can go to the Slow Food East End's website to find out more information about that, or my website. October 30th is a Taste of Long Island taking place all through downtown Patchogue. There's going to be live music and local craft beer and lots of tasting of Long Island produced food. October 30th, the North Shore Land Alliance is having a walk in the woods out at the Pete Cope Preserve in Oyster Bay Cove. Their events are really fun. November 1st, Just Food is having their 9th annual Let Us Eat Local tasting benefit. This is a great event if you have not gone to it. It's a bit pricey, but you are supporting a wonderful organization. Just Food is a nonprofit that has been helping to build urban gardens all throughout the city and help get food access into neighborhoods that normally weren't having it. So they're doing great work. If you can support them, it's at the Metropolitan Pavilion on November 1st. Dr. Robert Graham, who I met at TEDx Manhattan, he is was a doctor, actually, at Lenox Hill Hospital. He's now gone out on his own, and he has started a program that he teaches at the Natural Gourmet Institute to doctors, teaching them how to cook and how to use food as medicine. And he is doing an event that's open to the public at the Natural Gourmet, talking about living to 100. And he's looking at the Blue Zone diet that I'm sure many of you have heard about. I've talked about before. I've had guests on about that. Just, you know, little pockets on the planet where people are living beyond 100 and what their diet consists of. And so that should be an interesting evening. Open to everyone at the Natural Gourmet Institute. November 4th is the Farm-Based Educational National Gathering up in Concord, Massachusetts. You know, the Farm-Based Education Network is a wonderful organization bringing educators, farmers, and community leaders together. Should be a wonderful event. There's a lot of those going on now, really, you know, trying to raise that awareness. That's why it's just, I'm in this world so much that when I open the New York Times and I see the front page of sprinkles on cake, I just don't get it. I remember someone bringing those Italian delicacies that are green, red, and white to my house, and I actually told them to take them home. I just couldn't imagine having them out on the table. November 4th, Food Policy for Breakfast Series. This is goes on a regular basis up at Hunter College. Their Food Policy Breakfast Series is a wonderful free event open to the community. They show films. They have discussions. The topic of this one is the power of community gardens. And then the following week on November 9th, they have one for the impact of pesticides on human environmental health. So, again, check out my website for these. November 7th, the Long Island Accreditation course for organic land care is taking place on Long Island, sponsored by NOFA New York. That's the Northeast Organic Farming Association. It's an accredited course on organic land care, partnered with the Cornell Cooperative Extension of Suffolk County, taking place out in Riverhead. It's a 30-hour, 4-day course. And you'll cover everything from organic land care, principles, practices, design, and maintenance. It should be excellent. Growing Powers National Conference is coming up. They have this every 2 years. Will Allen, who started Growing Power, is a powerhouse, and this is a great event if you'd like to go out there and check that out. And that is everything that's going on around the city. And more, like I said, check out my website for more information. And before I introduce Patrick Holden on, I'd like to share with you my weekly recipe. I've been having requests for this recipe again. I shared it last year around Thanksgiving time. You know, I make a raw vegan cheesecake all the time. And this is, it's not raw because I actually used cooked pumpkin, but the rest of it, the crust and the filling is all raw, and it's vegan. It's a pumpkin cheesecake that you can make. You can put it in the freezer, bring it to room temperature to serve, and it goes back in the freezer if you didn't finish it, and you have it there for whenever you want to pull out a dessert, and it's just great. And it comes together so quickly. You can use either fresh pumpkin that you steam, or you can use a can of organic pumpkin. Either one works fine. So this is a vegan pumpkin cheesecake. For the crust, you're going to start with 1 cup of macadamia nuts, 1 cup of raw almonds, 1 cup of dates, 1/2 cup of dried unsweetened coconut, 1 pinch of sea salt, and 3/4 teaspoon of ground ginger. And that's for the crust. And then for the filling, 3 cups of cashews that you soak in water for 3 hours, 1/4 cup of lemon juice, 1 can of organic pumpkin or 2 cups of steamed pumpkin, 1 teaspoon cinnamon, 1/2 teaspoon ginger powder, 1/4 teaspoon ground cloves, 1/8 teaspoon allspice, 1/8 teaspoon of nutmeg, 1/4 teaspoon of salt, 3/4 cup of maple syrup, 3/4 cup of coconut oil, 1 tablespoon vanilla, and 1/2 cup of water. And then for the topping, I use 1 cup of pecans that I chop up, or you don't have to chop them, actually. The last time I made them, I actually decorated them as pecan halves, and it was really pretty on the top. And 1/4 cup of maple syrup, and you just toast those in a cast iron frying pan and put those on top. So you're going to start by pulsing all of the ingredients for the crust in a food processor until it's finely chopped. I usually do the nuts first, and then I add the dates and the coconut, and then continue pulsing until it all comes together. And the dates, the moisture from the dates is the only thing that's holding this crust together. And then you're going to press the crust into the bottom of a fluted tart pan that has a removable bottom. And that just makes access to the pie just so much easier. If you put it into a pie shell, you actually have a hard time cutting the pieces when they're frozen. So the removable bottom is really helpful in this case. So you press the crust in, and I actually, when I'm pressing in on the sides, I'm also pressing down, so I create a really nice, firm, fluted edge for the cheesecake. And then you wash out the food processor and put it back on the stand. And then for the filling, you're going to drain the cashews that you have been soaking. And then you're going to blend all of the ingredients for the filling in the food processor. And again, I usually start with the cashews just to really blend those up first, then add some of the liquid like the lemon juice, and then all the rest of the ingredients. And you're going to let that pulse it first till you really get it all mixed in, and then let it run for a few minutes so that it's really smooth and creamy. And then you're going to pour the filling into the tart pan and put it into the freezer for about an hour before putting that pecan topping on top. And like I said, the pecan topping, you can either chop them or put them whole. And you're going to just pour maple syrup over it and just toast them lightly in a cast iron frying pan before putting them on top of the cake. And then put it back into the freezer. And it can sit there. You can make it a week beforehand. It's really easy. Comes together so quickly, and it's so delicious. So enjoy it. I love feedback. If you want to write to me, you can at Bhavani@IEGreen with any questions or just feedback on how you like the cheesecake. Love to hear from everybody. Okay, and now it's my pleasure, again, to introduce Patrick Holden. He is the founding director of the Sustainable Food Trust, and prior to that, he was the founding director of the Soil Association, and he is just an amazing guy. Patrick, are you with me?
I'm with you, and that's a very wonderful welcome. I wasn't actually the founding director of the Soil Association, because that organization was born before I was, in 1946.
Oh, sorry.
And I wasn't born until 4 years after that.
So you were the founding director of the British Organic Farmers, right?
Correct.
Okay, and then that merged into the Soil Association, so I just had that mixed up. Okay. Thank you for setting it straight.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it's wonderful to be talking to you and reaching across the Atlantic. I'm sitting here in Bristol right now, but I have a farm in Wales just 100 miles from here to the west, where I shall be milking cows on Saturday.
Lovely. And so how long have you had your organic farm?
It's now the longest established organic dairy farm in Wales. We started as a bunch of hippies in 1973 on a back-to-the-land commune, which didn't last all that long, but the farm did. And now we've got the descendants of the original cows we bought back then in the milking herd today. And we're turning all the milk, or nearly all the milk, into a single farm cheddar-style cheese called Havod, which is sometimes on good days for sale in Murray's because it's exported into the U.S.
Uh-huh. And can you spell the name of it so that people can look for it?
It's spelled H-A-F-O-D, but F in Welsh is pronounced V, so it's pronounced Havod, Havod.
Uh-huh.
And it's a recipe which originally came from the Swiss mountains, you know, an Alpage cheese. It's just very exciting to be producing food with a story which then gets through to the final customer, which is something I've always wanted to do, but we've only managed to do in the last 5 years. So we've been on the farm now 43 years.
Wow. Long time. That's great. And so, but you don't live there anymore.
I actually wrote the very first draft of the organic dairy standards in the world, because we were having trouble selling our milk, and we thought, well, why not sell it to a market that would appreciate it and pay a little extra for our story? And I was working at the Soil Association at that time, and we had a livestock, organic livestock standards committee, and it was given the task of writing the first draft was given to me, which then became the UK national standards, which then was adopted by the European Union. And then the National Organic Program in the US picked up on the EU standards. So I've got a little tiny claim to in the architecture of the International Organic Standards.
Well, on behalf of someone that really appreciates that, thank you, Patrick. I appreciate that.
It was a pleasure. It didn't feel hard at the time.
So can you tell us about your latest venture, the Sustainable Food Trust, what it actually is, what your mission is, and, yeah, what you do?
Well, it's a small organization which I founded in 2011. Our mission is to accelerate the transition towards more sustainable food systems, working internationally. But really, we have paid most attention in the US and the UK, where, of course, we're based. And obviously, as the name implies, if we need to accelerate the transition towards more sustainable food systems, that suggests that we're not going fast enough. And although I recently read an article by a man whose Christian name escapes me, but his surname is Latham, called The Food Movement is an Unstoppable Force, which basically said the food movement is unstoppable because it's cellular and it's a ground-up movement and millennials are taking control of their future and they really get it. The fact is that if you look at where most of the food we eat is produced and how it's produced, you'll find it's from industrial farms and produced with a backstory that you really wouldn't want to know. And the reason why the food is produced like that is because there are incentives that encourage farmers to produce it that way, and there are other blockages in the food system. And our mission in the Sustainable Food Trust is try to unlock these barriers, thereby create conditions where a transition to 100% sustainable food production, which is what we need to address climate change and public health issues and the environment, will happen more quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why, you know, for him to write the food movement is an unstoppable force, and then to see the front page of the New York Times food section today, I'm telling you, I can't tell you how it just freaked me out. I mean, I just couldn't believe that would be a front page cover story of the food section.
What did you say it said?
It was a story about an artisanal bakery that opened up, and, you know, she started with all these, you know, really high-end quality, supposedly, ingredients, and then she caught wind of how popular the sprinkles were, and she started putting sprinkles on everything, and she just took off. And so now she has this, you know, sprinkle cake with sprinkles inside, sprinkles outside. And, you know, yeah. The other ingredients might be, you know, I doubt they're organic, but supposedly, you know, Madagascar vanilla and high-end stuff with sprinkles. And just, I remember working in nursery school and talking to parents about bringing in healthy snacks for the kids. And, you know, these kids are bringing in yogurt with sprinkles on top. And they just, you know, it's just baffles me how people don't make the connection.
Well, exactly. And the thing is, I think that story is very telling. It doesn't directly contradict the proposition that the food movement is an unstoppable force, but for it to reach its potential, because it rather reminds me that the number of young people, millennials, that are into good food now reminds me of what it was like to be around in the late 60s, early 70s, where there was a youth movement for change afoot at that time. But it all depends on how much knowledge people have. So if you don't know what the issues are that promote good health, you might not buy the right food or want to buy the right food. So a lot of this transition and transformation needs to be informed by good knowledge of the issues. And that, I think, is a huge challenge to make sure that as many people as possible know about what's wrong with the food today and why it's making them sick, and what we can do about it. And that is part of our mission, because we are working in three areas. One is to try to involve leaders and individuals and organizations in leadership positions to give them the new thinking and the new ideas which could result in our food systems being changed. Secondly, to look at the policies, because in many cases, for instance, in the Farm Bill, it's encouraging the wrong thing at the moment, and we need to make sure it encourages the right thing. And thirdly, we need to get the ideas across, which is what I've just been talking about. So those are the three strands of our mission.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and all three are important and challenging. I would almost think like, well, the first two are the harder ones. Get the ideas across, we do in so many different ways. We just hope the right people are listening. But to involve the leaders and get them to change the policies, especially, I don't know how it is in the UK, but here in the US, since there's so much money, thank you, United.
Yeah. I think you have a worse problem even than we do with the money issue, but we still have the same problem. I'm sure you heard this story about Obama meeting some leaders of the food movement, and they said to him, why aren't you doing more to support the food movement? And he allegedly said to them, show me the food movement. I don't feel the heat. So I think we have to take it upon ourselves as our failure that we were not a more powerful voice than the enormous financial power of the food industry. And we just have to up our game. And we can do that with social media. And we just need to remember to ourselves that individual people are the most powerful force for change in the world. They can do anything. We can do anything. And that's why the cellular nature of the food movement is its most important asset, as long as the people understand the issues.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure you noticed that there was not one question about climate change or food in any of the presidential debates. Actually, there was one about climate change, but barely.
And that's not, in the case of the Obamas, it's not because they don't get it. It's because the financial lobby is the more powerful force. In the case of Hillary, well, it's a discussion, isn't it? Let's just hope that she's listening to people like Kathleen Merrigan and others who are reminding her of what needs to change.
Right. Let's hope. Let's really hope.
Let's hope it's Hillary and not the other one.
Oh, well, thank God I'm starting to feel like, I'm starting to relax. I feel like it will be. It was really scary there for a little while. But I think he's kind of dug his grave, I'm hoping.
I think he's dug his own grave, which is a wonderful thing.
Of course, he's blaming others. He didn't dig it himself. But anyway, so one thing you just touched on, which is, again, something from the quote from Ronnie Cummins that I read, is how can we build this movement in a global way so that we do become such a loud voice? I mean, I know that's partly why I'm so involved in Slow Food, because I feel like they've been working on a global global area, but they need to up their game as well in the sustainable aspect of the food movement, not just the pleasures around the table, which we of course love and get, but
agree with that.
A commitment.
Yeah, I was
a commitment.
I was just in Milan at the Terra Madre gathering, the Slow Food Movement, a few weeks ago. And it's a very powerful movement for change, but I think you're right. There needs to be a little bit more emphasis on the sustainability element of the food production, as well as celebrating good food.
Right.
And I think that is beginning to happen. But you're right. I think there is a big challenge in making this a truly international movement. And just yesterday, in that connection, I was lucky enough to be a guest of a reception that Prince Charles held in London, which brought together, I think, maybe 30 or 40 countries, all of whom have signed up to this new scheme, which you may have heard of, called 4 per 1,000, which was launched by the French Minister of Agriculture, Monsieur Le Foll. And he had this idea that we could reverse climate change by changing the way we farm in such a way that we can rebuild the lost soil carbon that has escaped from the soil during the period of industrial agriculture, particularly in places like the Midwest and the Corn Belt. And we do that by going back to traditional farming systems which have crop rotation, which build soil fertility, because the soil is the world's largest carbon bank. And this initiative that the French government launched, which has been championed by Prince Charles ever since, is really catching on. More than 180 countries and major international organizations have now signed up to it. And it was really inspiring to hear all the ministers speaking in favor of it yesterday in London.
Was the U.S. representative? Were they there?
The U.S. was representative, but not the U.S. administration. But, you know, you have an ambassador, I don't know if you know, of Matthew Barzan. He's the British U.S. British ambassador, and he's been a huge champion of sustainable agriculture while he's been in London. I'm not sure that it's always been, I think he's gone out on a limb a bit, because I'm not sure that the current administration with Tom Vilsack and the USDA have been quite as enthusiastic about the sustainable ag cause as they could have been. But no, there was a U.S. representative there yesterday, and they need to sign up to this, because actually the Midwest is really where you could lock up a lot of soil carbon. If we abandoned the corn soy intensive farming and went back to traditional farming with a crop rotation which includes legumes and maybe even cattle as well.
Yeah. I just, you know, Monday was food day, and so I participated in a documentary screening that took place called Fresh. Do you know that film, Fresh?
Fresh, great. No.
It's a great documentary. You know, Will Allen is in it and Joel Salatin. Right. And, you know, it's kind of like Food Inc., except it's really talking about the farming and the, you know, the need to go back to traditional farming and how when you have a farm that's so balanced and you have the cows, you know, grazing, and then you follow them up with the chickens that then pick through it all, and then you follow it up with the pigs, and then you plant, you know, just how when you really have a farm that's working together as a single organism, it works. But when you break it apart and do it in this industrial manner, you're depleting everything on every level. You know, you have the problem from the soil side, and then you have the waste management problem when you raise the livestock in these industrial, you know, farming ways. And so, you know, we're just creating problems instead of when you work in the whole, you're solving problems. You know, it's doing good. It's just
totally
so frustrating.
I think you're right. We have to rebuild our food systems from the ground up. And I think Will Allen and Joel Salatin are two fantastic examples of that. I must watch the film, because we are hosting Joel Salatin in London and in Gloucestershire in November for three public meetings, where he will be talking about his system, hopefully inspiring a lot of farmers in the UK, as well as getting his ideas across to the media and the public. And we have a BBC program called On Your Farm, where they host a farmer normally on their farm, but in this case Joel will not be able to on his own farm, but it's like a really well listened to national public radio program with maybe up to a million listeners, and he's going to be on it, featured on it while he's with us, which is really exciting, because I went to his farm last November and it really inspired me. I think what he's doing is part of the future.
Yeah, we had him at our conference a few years ago as well. And he is. He's a powerhouse. He's so much fun to listen to. And you can feel it. He's so smart. He really understands it. And I think the way he relates to people and talks to people, he helps people hear it. So
I could not agree. I think he's one of the world's great ambassadors for sustainable agriculture at the moment, and particularly the role of livestock. This system he's using of mob grazing or holistic grazing, I've adopted that on my own farm, and I'm already seeing the results of it with increased grassland productivity, and I'm sure a lot more soil carbon as well, and the cattle do better on it.
Yeah, really great. Let's take a quick break, and when we come back, I want to touch on the issue when we met at Terra Madre, it was over the issue of the true cost of cheap food. And I really know that you really spent a lot of time looking at that, and I really want to explain that to my listeners a little bit. So everyone listening, don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. I'm talking with Patrick Holden from the Sustainable Food Trust. Be right back.
South of the border, down around Mexico.
I'm Johnny Mueller, host of the Expat Files, living in Latin America. Heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Sunday at 12:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. It's a show where you'll learn how to work, play, do business, or retire and live the life of Riley. Yes, an amazing number of first world people like you are jumping off the stateside treadmill and voting with their feet. And surprise, surprise, they're finding there really is an American dream. But it's not in Seattle, Milwaukee, or Cleveland anymore. It's down here in Latin America. So be sure to tune in to the Expat Files to find out how you can live the good life on a measly Social Security check.
I'm Glenn Ford.
And I'm Nellie Bailey.
Every Monday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, we bring you Black Agenda Radio here on the Progressive Radio Network. It's produced by the team at blackagendareport.com, the cutting-edge publication for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left.
So check out our view of the world and explore our rich archives on prn.fm. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward.
And we hope you're coming with us.
Stay tuned to PRN.FM for more empowering ideas from progressive voices. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm here with Patrick Holden from the Sustainable Food Trust, and we were just about to get into the true cost of cheap food. Patrick, you with me?
I am.
Great. So what does it mean when we say the true cost of cheap food? I mean, cheap food's cheap, so what is not cheap about it?
Well, when we buy food, we assume that the price we pay reflects the true cost of production, but actually that isn't the case. We live in a world with dishonest food pricing, and by that I mean that if food is produced in a way which causes emissions, which cause climate change, or groundwater pollution, which gets into the reservoirs and then has to be cleaned up by the water companies, or with residues that end up in the food and affect our health, all these are real hidden costs, but if the farmer is not paying for them as part of the production process, then those costs don't appear on the price of the food that we buy in the shops. Conversely, if food is produced in a sustainable way and the result of the food production is that we build soil carbon and that takes CO2 out of the atmosphere, or it promotes public health and saves health treatment costs, those are benefits which all are part of the value of the food. But instead of having a system, a pricing system which reflects that, which in an ideal world would mean that the sustainable food would be the most affordable because it delivers the most benefits, and the intensively produced food which causes damage would be the most expensive, it's the opposite. How strange that is, that we have to pay more for food which is good for us and the planet, and much less for food which is damaging to the environment and to our own health. We want to do something about that, and we organized a conference in San Francisco called The True Cost of American Food back in April, at which we shone the light on these issues, and we tried to discover what it is that's causing these problems and how we could do something about it. I'll give you an example. We had a guy from Kaiser Permanente, the big health insurance and hospital company on the West Coast, saying we have an unaffordable public health emergency on our hands. They should know because they're having to charge more in the health insurance premiums, and they're also treating the patients in the hospitals. And they've done some studies where they see that there are hot spots in the Central Valley where the workers, the farm workers, are exposed to bad air pollution from these cattle factories or from pesticide residues, and it's giving them allergies and cancers, and they're seeing the damage. So we need to think about how we can change this, and this would in part be to look at the farm bill, crop insurance, subsidies for ethanol production, all these kinds of issues, and start to redirect those subsidies in such a way that the farmers who farm in a more sustainable way benefit from them, and the farmers who are doing damage don't get any subsidies. And this would be a way in which we could introduce carrots and sticks to make sure that in the future, most people can get access to sustainably produced food instead of the present situation where you have to be a kind of elite minority to be able to afford the food, which is crazy because everybody should, it should be everybody's right to have this food. And that's one of our big projects.
Mm-hmm. How can people get involved in this? Because it seems like, you know, we're talking about trying to build a global movement. Where do people get started? I mean, I'm involved in the movement, and yet I don't, you know, I'm sharing knowledge with people and educating people, but I still feel like I want to do more. I want to, you know, what can people do to really wake up the people that are making the policies?
I think that's a fantastic question, because in the end, it's each of us individually that will be the force that changes this. Because you know what I said earlier about Obama said, I don't feel the heat of the food movement.
Right.
Well,
right.
If each of us became a lobbyist for this and used social media to send messages to the politicians and put pressure on the people who can change these levers, this would be powerful. One thing you could do is to visit our website, Sustainable Food Trust, www.sustainablefoodtrust.org, and go to the film of the conference, because every single one of the True Cost of American Food conference sessions was filmed and is on our website. And you can listen to the guy, watch the guy from Kaiser Permanente speak. Prince Charles also gave the message at the conference a video message of support. And there was a fantastic session where we had three farmers. Joel Salatin was one of them. We had Strauss Organic Dairy from Marin. And we had a corn soy farmer from Minnesota, all talking about their system, and a man from Australia who was an expert in looking at the true cost of and the value of their farming systems went and visited all their farms and came up with an adjusted price for all the food. It's completely fascinating, one of the plenary sessions at the conference. So that's one way to learn more, but also there are organizations like Food Tank that are championing this cause, and there are many research institutes and universities that are getting interested in this now. So really the true cost of our food and learning more about that and where what the problem is and what we can do about it is one of the key issues of our time, because otherwise sustainable food production is not going to go mainstream, and that's what we need it to be.
Mm-hmm. You know, I don't mean to be a cynic, but, you know, in this country, I'm convinced since we don't have national health care and people pay for their own health care, it's all so interconnected. It is good business for our country to keep people sick. I mean, it benefits the doctors, it benefits the hospitals, it benefits the pharmaceutical companies, it benefits the cheap food producers, it benefits the manufacturers. You know, everybody makes money when we're sick. If we were eating healthy food and we weren't getting sick, think of all the people that would go out of business. So it's, you know, I hate to believe it. I hate to believe that that people know this and are choosing to make us sick. But
let's think about this, though, because let's say we've got Kaiser Permanente. They might be making money out of treating people in hospitals, but they are saying publicly that this needs to change. And one way that they would gain financial advantage from changing it would be if they could offer lower health insurance premiums to people who ate organic and sustainable food. And we could encourage the health insurance companies to do that. I mean, I met somebody on a plane, actually, who worked for Humana, and apparently they have a scheme for their own employees where if they go on a healthy diet and they do more exercise, they benefit from lower health insurance premiums. So we are the powerful ones because we are buying their products, namely the health insurance policies. And we can act as individual citizens and selectively go to health insurance companies that offer a lower premium for people who eat better. What about that?
I think that's great. Actually, I had the executive director of NOFA New York, the Northeast Organic Farming Association, on last week. And she was talking about how they're working on doing something the same way health insurance companies do give discounts to people that join a gym. You know, you have to go a certain amount of times, but they know that helps your health. They get discount. People that have a CSA membership, so they know that they're getting have a CSA membership that the insurance company or the companies that they work for would help pay for the membership for the CSA because they know that that's going to have a long-term effect in their health.
I love that. I love that. That's perfect. That's the sort of thing. That's taking action, and it's empowering for you as an individual, but it also helps change the system. And we have a so-called National Health Service, which would be better named the National Disease Treatment Service. But you'd think it would be easier to get the government to pick up on this, because after all, they're having to pay the bill for all this health treatment. But it's still difficult because there are still vested interests involved. And it's not just the vested interests. It's the power of an entrenched orthodoxy. You know, if something's really well established and you say this is bad and it needs to be changed, there's an awful lot of inertia and it's very hard to get people to listen to an argument that it could be really different. But that's what we need now, because we are poisoning the planet and we are actually poisoning ourselves with our present food systems. It cannot go on like this.
I totally agree with you. What do you say to promoters of GMOs? I mean, like in the UK, What's the status of GMOs? There's mandatory labeling, or at one point I know they didn't allow it. Where are you at with GMOs in your country, and what do you say when people say you need GMOs to feed the planet?
In most European countries, it's effectively not available at all, genetically modified food, except livestock products. And there's a huge gap there because there is no requirement for labeling livestock products which have been fed GMOs, as a result of which a very large amount of soya and corn, which is in many cases comes from the US, is imported as animal feed, which is fed to poultry, to pigs, to hogs, and to dairy cattle. And so we're getting GM food through the back door. And there is a growing body of evidence that the herbicide Roundup, which is routinely sprayed on GMO crops to kill off all the other plants other than the herbicide-tolerant crop, namely the corn and the soy, is finding its way into the food that we eat. It is a known carcinogen. And there is now an emerging body of evidence that Roundup residues are directly linked to bad health outcomes. And I am actually a great champion of the need for more research into this area, not just the GMO foods themselves, but also the Roundup, which is associated with the herbicide tolerant crops. We need more long-term feeding trials to determine the extent to which this is really damaging our health, and I'm personally certain that it is. All we need is the money to finance a second major long-term animal feeding trial involving rats, and we now have an Italian research institute called the Ramazzini Institute, which is keen to do this work, and I'm very much hoping that enough money can be raised to fund this long-term research project on behalf of all the people in the world who should be worried about the effect of Roundup on human health and the GMOs crops associated with them.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I've actually read some research that talks about, some Roundup, or some of the GMOs are actually spliced so that they're resistant to Roundup when it's sprayed on the fields and it's killing the weeds. But then there's also the GMO that where it has the Roundup actually in the gene, so that when you are eating it, you're ingesting the Roundup.
Yeah.
And I have heard that continues inside your intestine to produce the Roundup, to produce the pesticide. Have you heard that?
The first generation of genetically modified crops they're either tolerant to a poison, namely Roundup or glyphosate, which is the active ingredient, or they have Bacillus thuringiensis, BT, a BT toxin, which is basically expressed inside the plant, and therefore the plant becomes toxic to caterpillars and insects. So we're actually breeding a plant now which has a poison inside it. And when you really think about that, What a crazy thing to do. And
right.
It's hard
That's
to believe that if you're eating a plant which has a poison inside it, it's not going to have a long-term effect on our health as well as the health of the insects that eat it. It's almost, if you told it like a children's story, you would not believe this thing would happen, yet it has happened. And it has to stop because it is totally incompatible with the principles of sustainable agriculture. It allows monocultures. The only reason why the pests and the fungal diseases and the weeds are there is because we've got the wrong kind of farming practice. We need to be treating we're treating the symptom, not the cause. And to redress this problem, we need to farm in a different way to produce healthier crops. And that means obeying the principle of diversity and going back or forward to traditional crop rotations.
Right. Yeah, I was reading about a talk that you gave where you were talking about how we need to go back to biology to fix the soil and not the chemistry, which is the artificial, you know, the additives that we're trying to put into the soil to fix it. Can you touch on that a little bit?
Yeah. Have you come across the concept of the human microbiome, which is, you know, the story about how there are more organisms in our body, three times as many actually, or maybe even more than that, than there are cells, most of them in the form of bacteria that live in our stomachs. And those bacteria have a dynamic and beneficial impact on our health all the time. And in fact, many problems that we've got with a whole range of diseases, from obesity to obviously diarrhea and diseases like that, but also diseases of the immune system, allergies, and even depression can be linked in one way or another with the degree of health of our stomach flora. And what we've been doing is wiping them out through the routine use of antibiotics, some of which we take as insurance medicine, but some of which we take in our food. And there's been a mass extinction of some of the rarer forms of the bacteria going on in our guts. And what is interesting about this is that if we understand that our stomachs hold the key to our own health and we need the diversity of the bacteria in them, exactly the same thing is true of the soil. We have been waging war on the biology of the soil with industrial agriculture, with chemical fertilizers and with pesticides, fungicides, herbicides, the result of which is the soil has become dead. And the plants, if you think of the plant root zone, it's like the stomach of the plant. And all plants have a symbiotic relationship with the bacteria and fungi in their own root zone. They actually feed them, and then the bacteria and the fungi help break down the organic matter in the soil. And because of the chemical era of agriculture, we've wiped out a lot of these beneficial organisms. So we're facing the same problem in the soils of our country as we are in our own stomachs, and we have to do something about that. And the key is to move our mindset from a chemical mindset to a biological mindset. Biology and bacteria hold the key to the future of healthy agriculture and food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you talk about a symbiotic relationship with the microbes and the soil. You know, that same symbiotic relationship I've done, you know, some reading about with our own flora in our intestines, how we had symbiotic relationships with something like even like a ringworm. I mean, I was reading this story about someone going to Africa to get ringworms so he could get rid of his allergies, because he had read that, you know, if, you know, everyone used to have ringworm and no one had allergies, and it would just live inside of you and cause whatever irritation, you know, it induced your own immune system to be fighting it off, and that kept you healthy. It was just
very
interesting.
Fascinating. There's a guy whose work inspired a lot of the founders of the sustainable food movement called Albert Howard. He was a British scientist who went to India to teach the Indian farmers how to improve their methods and adopt Western technologies at the beginning of the 20th century. But he had the humility to realize that he had nothing to teach these farmers because they were practicing truly sustainable agriculture. He wrote a book when he got back to England in 1940, because he spent 35 years there, in which he said, we should come to regard pests, diseases, and parasites as nature's professors of good husbandry, because they reveal to us our management deficiencies. So instead of seeing them as the enemy that has to be eliminated, they're all serving a purpose, and in many cases are indicators. So it's not that the presence of these organisms is necessarily bad. We have to understand what they're telling us and learn and farm or eat accordingly.
Mm-hmm. It is. It's so fascinating. And, you know, with antibiotics and, I mean, everybody's germ phobia and, you know, they say the healthiest kids are ones growing up on farms, making mud pies and eating in the, you know, playing in the dirt. I mean, we're just
I've got four youngish boys, and none of them have ever had antibiotics. And, of course, they grew up on a livestock farm. I think there's so much truth in this. It all turns on our attitude towards bacteria. We've been scared of them. We're a culture which has a pathological fear of pathogens, and we need to reverse that. And when you think about it, whether it's cheese making or sourdough bread or our relationships with our own digestion, it's all about bacteria.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why I think there's so much question as to whether hydroponics, which is, you know, becoming this new, you know, bustling new industry here in the U.S., growing organic hydroponic tomatoes, you know, where they never come in contact with any type of bacteria, as being the new way of creating food. And I just don't get it. I mean, anybody that knows anything talks about to be organic is all about the soil. You know, that's Will Allen's favorite line. It's all about the soil. And, you know, can you grow something organic and remove soil?
Of course you can't. And funnily enough, when we were developing the organic standards that I mentioned at the beginning of this discussion at a London meeting, there was a big lobby to promote soilless organic production. And we argued against it. We said basically it violated the fundamental principle of organic production. So Will Allen is right. And it's crazy. I mean, it's rather like feeding a patient in a hospital with a feeding tube, putting the nutrients in solution. You're bypassing this incredible processes which take place in the root zone of a plant where it spends a third of its energy exuding sugary sap into its root zone to nourish the symbiotic community of bacteria and fungi which live in the soil. Well, mm-hmm. if you bypass that, you're going to get a sick plant, and in the end, you'll get a sick person. So
right.
Hydroponics are not part of the future of sustainable food production.
I'm so glad to hear you say that. And I think it's really important for people to, you know, distinguish the difference and for them to have to label it, you know, that it's hydroponic and, you know, that organic shouldn't go along with hydroponic. I mean, hydroponic, you might be able to grow it without having to spray extra pesticides. That could be true, but it's still not going to be organic and have the same nutritional quality and be healthy for you the way something grown in soil is going to be.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Patrick, it has been such a pleasure. Thank you. I could go on and on talking with you. Thank you for joining us. And everyone...
Well, the pleasure's mutual.
Thank you. And I will share links to your conference with all of my listeners and get them to go to your website. And thank
wonderful.
You again. It's been wonderful.
Thank you so much. It's been a mutual pleasure then. Thank you.
You're welcome. And everybody out there, thanks for joining us. You've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. See you next week. Bye.
I'm a